You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Three generations of the Cousteau family have made contributions to ocean exploration, but 25 years ago, they also ventured into a river, the world's most important river, the Amazon. And recently, Jean-Michel Cousteau, along with his daughter Céline and son Fabien, ventured back into the area. Their journey is the subject of a two-part documentary called Return to the Amazon, and the second part airs tonight at 8 p.m. on PBS. I'm very pleased to welcome Fabien Cousteau to the show today. Hello.
Thank you very much.
How old were you when you and your family first visited the Amazon?
The Amazon was in the early 80s, so I must have been about 15 years old.
Old enough to have noticed what was going on. Did you find a lot of serious changes since you were there 25 years ago?
There have been huge changes. You're talking about a quarter century later, which of course dates me, unfortunately. But, in three generations or a quarter century, through my own eyes, have been able to see, when I was in a teenager, a place such as Manaus, which is the capital of Amazonas, the Amazon state in the Amazon River Basin. Manaus went from about 400,000 people 25 years ago to over 2 million today.
Wow.
So that in itself, just in a localized area, is a huge impact.
Well, was the area dominated by indigenous people when you were there last time, or had the population explosion already started?
You know, the Amazon is a very intricate place, and in terms of human populations, it's been quite a mix since it's been discovered by Western civilizations, or European civilizations, more appropriately. Over time, things have gotten very mixed, so it's kind of hard to answer that question in the sense that you find Indians or people of multiple upbringings that are intermixed within the culture of Manaus and the state of Amazonas.
Is the influx of people the main problem the Amazon faces?
I think bad habits are really the main cause of the problems. One of the things that really is an asset, in a sense, to the Amazon River, especially, again, in the state of Amazonas, in that general region, is that the populations have grown, but they've grown in localized areas. They haven't spread too much into the far-reaching forests. So you have a lot of virgin forest left, but that's being threatened as well.
So the population is mostly along the river. But
absolutely.
That must have had a real impact on the river.
Well, you know, the Amazon in general is such a hard place to navigate and to go through that the rivers are the highways and local roads of the local people, and of course of trade and commerce.
This is a river unlike any other river. You actually show how it used to flow into the Pacific, now flows into the Atlantic, and really is, as much as anything, the responsible for the development of the rainforest.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of geography, it's fascinating. Over the last 100 plus million years, the Andes Mountains, of course, came up and changed the flow of the Amazon from Pacific to Atlantic. And in human civilization terms, anyway, we've always seen it flow into the Atlantic. But it's largely responsible for what the Amazon is.
So the health of the river is important to the health of the rainforest.
The health of the river is essential not only to the health of the rainforest, but everything that depends on it and lives in it, including all the way to ourselves here in New York City.
And we keep on hearing that, the Amazon plays a central role in regulating global climate. So it would be important to us here in New York City or anywhere else in the world.
It's enormously impactful to our well-being and us to its well-being. The term global warming, which should be actually climate change, is something that's very much affected by the health or the detriment of the Amazon rainforest and its basin.
My guest is Fabien Cousteau, who is one of the three Cousteaus who went into the Amazon River, the area and in the river itself, for a two-part documentary called Return to the Amazon. And the second part will be broadcast tonight at 8 p.m. on PBS Channel 13 here in New York. How different is river diving from diving in the ocean?
Where do I start? The Amazon is quite an interesting place. River diving in general, you're dealing with everything from fairly slow currents to very, very quick currents. So depending on the equipment you're wearing and carrying, that could be a huge factor.
Whereas the ocean, it's pretty much a steady state?
Well, it depends where you go in the ocean. Of course, you have currents from tides and from eddies and things like that. The fact that you've got a constant current in the Amazon, for example, in rivers such as the Rio Negro and such, is definitely a factor. The fact that for the most part, the Amazon River is a very muddy and very nutrient-rich environment, so visibility is very poor.
So the film crew must have had a difficult time.
Oh, very difficult. You know the fish are there. You know the animals are there. But to film them is quite a different thing. So you've got all these things playing tricks on you and against you to try and get these pictures on air.
And since not all of the animals are known well, there were a few cases where you weren't sure whether you were swimming very close to something that could easily kill you.
And we very well may have and not known it, but we've come up on all sorts of interesting creatures haphazardly half the time, just because the visibility at best was something around 5 meters or 15 feet.
One of the other problems is that you weren't leaving a bubble trail.
Yes. Well, we used a technology called rebreather technology, which is a closed-circuit system as opposed to scuba, which lets bubbles out into the water, and therefore you also have noise and a distraction for the animals. We chose rebreathers because we wanted to be as stealth as possible, but for our surface crew who were trying to keep track of where we were, it was just about as problematic as it was for us to try and find the animals.
Members of your crew encountered a pink river dolphin. It's called a boto?
A boto, yes.
Are freshwater dolphins common in the Amazon?
Well, in the Amazon, there are two types of freshwater dolphins, and they're fairly common in the sense that they're around and you can find them. That said, they're also endangered in comparison with the original numbers, and they've been protected, especially the boto, which is an icon of the Amazon and its health.
But they've also been hunted by locals.
Absolutely.
Are they considered valuable?
Well, you know, it's very complex in the sense that the majority of the population, at least in Brazil, considers the boto a very spiritual animal, and it's responsible for a lot of legends, such as the boto changing into a beautiful man or a beautiful woman and intermingling with people in the local villages. Of course, you can tell them apart because they wear a hat to hide their blowhole. So if you see someone walking around with a hat, it's most likely a boto. And then on the opposite side of the coin is recently there's been a trend by certain fishermen, usually from outside the river basin, that go and hunt these dolphins to cut them up into bait for bottom feeding fish, such as catfish. And that's been responsible, at least in localized regions such as the Mamirawa Reserve, for a 10% decrease in these animals in just a few years.
Well, we've been hearing that there are more species of fish estimated to be living in the Amazon than in the Atlantic Ocean. But nobody knows for sure?
Well, the numbers are already there. There are, as far as discoveries, there are already more species of fish that live in the Amazon than in the whole of the Atlantic, or than the whole of the Atlantic Ocean.
So, is it in danger of being fished out, considering that there's so many different fish there?
The problem is, yes, the pressures are such that as we're learning, as we're discovering new species every day, there are many species that have gone extinct or have been fished out or have been hunted to the point where we will never know that they existed.
There's another large freshwater fish called the pirarucu. Are they endangered?
Well, the Piruruku, back when we were there in the early 80s, was endangered as already because it's a very good eating fish. It's a very tender flesh, a very white meat, and it's a very large fish. And it had already at that point become a commercially exchanged fish and a very easy fish to hunt because it comes up for air every 15 minutes, so it's fairly easy to find. And
a fish comes up for air?
Yes, it's a lung-breathing fish, believe it or not. It's a very prehistoric-looking fish. And although it does have gills, its gills only exchange about 5 to 10% of the oxygen that it actually requires. So it does come up for a breath of air. And back in the 80s, it got overfished and so became very endangered. And luckily for certain efforts such as the Mamiro Reserve and government restrictions, there are signs of recovery in a couple of regions of the Amazon in terms of this fish.
Well, the government is trying to do things to redress the problems. At the same time, is responsible for a lot of the problems, isn't it? For example, a large percentage of Brazil's power is generated by hydroelectric dams, and those dams are affecting the Amazon River.
It's an enormous problem. The dams, I mean, it's not unique to the Amazon. Of course, we have these same problems all over the world. But the problem with the Amazon is that it is the second largest river in the world. It flows 200 miles into the Atlantic Ocean. A lot of the fish, not only the freshwater fish, but the migratory fish, require this passageway, so to speak, into the alveoli of the Amazon River. To go into quieter waters to breed and to find protection. And if you cut those areas off with these dams, they have nowhere to go.
What about the effect on the forest itself? Because the river really is providing nurturance for the rainforest.
One of the magical cycles of the Amazon is the dry season and the rainy season. And when we go into the rainy season, a lot of these low-lying tropical rainforests in the Amazon get flooded. And this brings about a lot of nutrients into these flooded forests and vice versa. And a lot of these animals, especially aquatic animals, use these flooded forests as protection and as breeding grounds during the rainy season. And by putting dams and otherwise changing the flows of the water, you're also changing the possibilities of that happening.
What about its impact on rainfall?
Well, rainfall is a very complex problem. The rainfall is in the Amazon is responsible for about one-fifth of the total freshwater in the world. And if you start using techniques such as slash-and-burn agriculture and illegal logging, which is, of course, partly our problem here around the world because we are the consumers of this illegal logging, you all of a sudden you become... You're creating a desert, in a sense.
But the damming also kills trees.
And the damming,
and
of course, kills
trees. The loss of all these trees means they can't release water into the atmosphere, and that causes a decrease in rainfall.
Absolutely. It's a domino effect. It's like a three-dimensional web where you take and destroy one of the bonds. It affects everything around it. So with the example of the dam right north of Manaus, it's supposed to have been big enough to supply all the water needs of Manaus, which it actually only supplies about 20%, which is unfortunate. They've managed to kill or flood hundreds of thousands of acres, and those trees are now destroyed and are not giving back to the environment.
Hasn't this also led to increased levels of methane in the atmosphere?
Of course. There are multiple problems with regards to flooding and with regards to the destruction of the rainforest. And methane is definitely another problem. And of course, it's a global a contributor to global change.
My guest is Fabien Cousteau. The second part of a two-part documentary called "Return to the Amazon," involving the Cousteau family, his father Jean-Michel, and his sister Céline, will be broadcast tonight on PBS stations around the country, and we will continue our conversation after this. ¶¶ We're talking to Fabien Cousteau, who is one of the participants in Return to the Amazon, a special two-part presentation of the Jean-Michel Cousteau Ocean Adventures series, which premiered on PBS on the 2nd of this month. And now the second part is being broadcast tonight at 8 p.m. One of the things that stunned me, Fabien, in the film, was that people are buying canned fish in the Amazon area. They're buying imported canned tuna.
Well, you'll be able to see part of that story tonight, actually. It's shocking in the sense that, here are a people who were living in a symbiotic relationship with the Amazon and were provided with everything they needed. And now we're at a point where there's not enough because it's been overfished over the last few decades. And they're starting to import tuna, which is a saltwater fish, from the Pacific into areas that are as remote as Iquitos and beyond to supplement their diets, which is a real telling sign of what's going on.
Now, I remember when I was a kid and I'd see films about the Amazon and the indigenous people, and they usually were dangerous. You weren't sure whether you'd return. Now we are told that the indigenous people of the Amazon are the world's greatest environmentalists.
They always have been, though. You know, the local peoples, it's amazing what they know and how well they've lived with their environment. We could learn a lot from them. And they've always been environmentalists, but we've never listened. And that's one of the shameful things, because we're, in a sense, killing our ancestors instead of learning from them. And I think that's the root of the whole problem.
It seems to me another problem is simply that Brazil quite reasonably wants to find space for its growing population. People want to have farms. People want to be able to get out of those congested cities. And they got all of this land that is pretty much virgin territory.
You know, it's a very complicated problem. And
we deforested the whole North America as we developed it. And now we're saying to Brazil, don't do the same thing we did.
Well, we have a tendency in the Western world to do exactly that. Say, do what we say, not what we do. But at the end of the day, it's one of those problems that, yes, we've made the mistakes, and we recognize some of the mistakes that we've made. And in order for the world to have a chance and benefit from all that knowledge, we should share that knowledge free of charge to the rest of the world, including the Brazilian government, the Peruvian government, and so on and so forth, so that we may all benefit from the health of an ecosystem such as the Amazon River Basin.
What percentage of the Amazon forest has been lost to logging in the past 30 years? Do we know?
Well, we're down, I think the numbers lately have been somewhere around 20% of the total Amazon River Basin has been cut and destroyed either for farming of soy or cattle or just deforestation for illegal logging in the last 25, 30 years.
An area the size of Texas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, an area the size of Texas or France. It's enormous.
And is that because it's just so rich in mahogany and cedar and other woods that people value?
It's not only a very rich place in terms of resources, but it's also one that I think people see this as such a vast wilderness. And this is the same problem we had 200-300 years ago here in this country and earlier on in Europe. It seems that it's never ending. It's this vast green rainforest that we can all take from and not give back to, because it's vast and endless. It's like the ocean. And now, because of technology, because of satellites, because of planes, we can see what we're doing in real time, and it's alarming. We're getting to a point now where if we cut much more than that 20% down of the rainforest, you're going to get a auto desertification of the area, which means that we won't even be touching the rest of the rainforest, and it's going to start wilting away.
But didn't the Brazilian government have policies that encouraged landowners to clear-cut their lands?
Governments are a funny thing. They're our best ally in terms of trying to change policy, and they're also sometimes a real dilemma because they have short-term agendas for when they're in office. So they're going to make those decisions based on that rather than our future and the long-term effects of what their decisions make.
And they're making money from all of this. For example, those valuable hard lumbers are, I'm sure, mean real export dollars or whatever the equivalent is. What is the Brazilian currency? Do you know? Cruzeiro?
The Brazilian currency is the peso. God, I've traveled whatever. So many times in the last.
But where does that lumber go? Is that mostly come here?
98% of that lumber goes to the United States, to Europe, and increasingly now to Asia. And whether it be mahogany or cedar or some of the other rare woods, it's the appetite of the average consumer that is fueling this fire and is a multi-billion dollar industry. The answer is very simple, and it rests in each and every one of our laps. It's our conscious decision making in our everyday lives. If we choose to get sustainable lumber or certifiedly sustainable lumber rather than this illegal lumber, then we've already made a change.
It's illegal. It's being cut down illegally?
There's only one place that I know of in Brazil that cuts lumber certifiably or with certifications from the Brazilian government, and that's the Jari Pulp Mill. There may be other smaller organizations that do so as well, but they're very strict regulations that very few people follow because either it's not enforced or they don't know because they're an average farmer and so on and so forth, or their ulterior motives, of course.
And also, once illegal wood winds up in a lumber mill, it's no longer considered illegal.
Well, that's a huge problem, and that's a loophole in the system. You have people, whether they be a poor average person who is desperate to feed their family or a huge industry, going into the forest and cutting everything away to get that one tree, dragging it through the forest, destroying acres just to get that tree into the water, which, like I said, is the highway. And once it's in the water and it gets dragged to a lumber mill, the lumber mill is not responsible for that illegal tree being illegal. All they're doing is a service by cutting it up into planks and such. So, yes, that is a loophole.
My guest is Fabien Cousteau. He and his father and sister made a film, another film, about the Amazon, Return to the Amazon, which is being broadcast tonight. The second part, anyway, is being broadcast tonight. I don't know, will the first part be repeated?
Absolutely. They repeat it every few days. As a matter of fact, this weekend will be, both parts will be playing again.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So we have all this deforestation, and the government has encouraged it, or I guess it encouraged it more during the military dictatorship. Have policies improved?
Well, you know, there was a scare when the military took over the government. They encouraged the average people to go out into the forest and claim the forest for their own, free of charge. One of the stipulations was that they had to show that the land that they've claimed is productive. Well, by productive, they mean is something of a farm, such as a cattle ranch. Well, as we all know, if you want a cattle ranch, you have to cut down acres and acres to have pastures. It's the same thing with the soy production, which is increasingly getting to be a problem all over the Amazon River Basin, because that becomes, for example, feed for 70% of European stock, cattle and such, or it goes into 90% of the foods that we eat. It's surpassing the problem of cattle. In any event, the goodwill, in a sense, to try and get people to go out and claim the Amazon rainforest actually backfired. And so we've got these huge areas of pastures where there once was forest, especially in the area of Mato Grosso and Rondônia and so on, that are examples that we shouldn't repeat in the rest of the Amazon.
American companies are involved in this as well. Cargill has played a major role in all that soybean cultivation in the Amazon.
Well, yeah, companies such as Cargill, which are huge grain and soy depots and distribution centers, buy their products from the local farmers. And we depend on companies such as that to regulate where they get their products from, the raw materials. And so sometimes decisions are not made properly, or maybe through ignorance of where that product comes from, there are a lot of problems with deforestation.
Many years ago, we had a guest here who was involved in going through the Amazon searching for plants that might have medicinal qualities. Mm. And his concern was all of this was going to kill those plants before we even found out whether they would be useful in fighting cancer or Parkinson's or some other disease.
Well, it's a race against time, in a sense, because there are so many products out there, pharmaceuticals and such, and medicines that have already are already dependent on a lot of plants and trees that exist in the rainforest in the Amazon, that we're basically cutting the grass from under our feet. And we've only discovered maybe 10 to 15% of what the Amazon rainforest has to offer.
And a black marketeer offered you a rare Amazon cat.
Yeah, that was one of the more, I'd say probably one of my most moving moments in our expedition, our 10 and a half months down in the Amazon. It was the illegal trade of animals, which is running rampant all over the place. And our personal experience was a individual had come up to my sister and I and had offered this margay, this juvenile margay, to us for purchase. Luckily, the
margay is like
margay is like a spotted cat, like an ocelot.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually very close cousins, and beautiful cat, but very rare. And you know, despite what the story was that we heard from this particular individual, we had the feeling that this cat was poached, and the environmental government agency, IBAMA, stepped in and had given us this cat to take care of and to bring back to the Amazon forest by means of giving it to a tribe which would take care of it and nurse it back into nature. So it was kind of a little emotional symbol of giving back.
I imagine if you were offered that cat, other visitors have been offered. Are we seeing a major theft of indigenous animals from the Amazon?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the big problems. This big exodus of illegal animal trade is emptying the rainforest between the jaguars and the ocelots and the parrots and the tropical fish and so on and so forth. It's a huge problem. And you know, whether it be the average tourist that feels bad for the animal and decides to buy it and bring it home, or whether it be a professional organization black marketing these animals, it's a mass exodus that needs to be curtailed and hopefully stopped.
One of our listeners has called in to inform us that the currency of Brazil is the real.
Thank you. That was going to drive me crazy.
What impact is the construction of the Trans-Amazonia Highway going to have? We're having.
You know, that's such an intricate and complicated issue. When you have, we were able to travel a lot of these dirt roads that are becoming paved and becoming highways, such as the BR-163, which is the dirt road that connects Santarém to south to Mato Grosso, and where logging and soy and all that is dependent on this kind of avenue to get it to the water, to the river, and then eventually to the oceans. The same thing with the Trans-Amazonas Highway that's being built. You have not only a facilitation of all these products being shipped back and forth, not only from the Atlantic, but now also to the Pacific. You also have a secondary effect, which is a herringbone effect, where you have deforestation on the sides of these logging routes and these highways from individuals and farmers that are settling on the sides. Well, then there they create secondary roads, and you have more settlement, and then tertiary roads, and so on and so forth. And it looks like a herringbone. And each one of these people clears some of that land, whether it be for farming or for their own personal use. And certainly it becomes this ongoing problem that's cutting down the rainforest.
You and Celine are the third generation of Cousteaus involved in this kind of activity. Usually at least one of the kids rebels and goes off into something else, paints or becomes a doctor or a lawyer.
How about all of them?
Was there ever a question of you not becoming involved in environmental issues or going underwater?
You know, it's a question that's been asked many times, and it's one that I've never really had a very good answer for, in the sense that when I've been diving since my fourth birthday, and my sister has been diving since she was a teenager, and we've been surrounded by a family that's been doing that ever since we were born. And so we're sensitive to certain things that are going on around the world because of our travels and because of the way we were brought up and the way we were educated. And to turn your back on something so powerful, so important, that gives us such passion, is being very irresponsible. After college, I tried going into the business world, and my sister as well. And although it was satisfying in a financial way, it really didn't give us the kind of satisfaction at the end of the day where we get up in the morning and want to do it all over again. And that's why we're continuing on in the family tradition.
Just one more thing. The Amazon is 4,200 miles long.
Absolutely.
How much of that did you actually cover?
Well, we'd like to say all of it, but that's that'd be a gross exaggeration. We did manage to spot check, so to speak, over the 10 and a half months we were in the Amazon, all the way from Mount Mismi, which is the source of the Amazon, to the actual mouth of the Amazon, which is over 200 miles wide.
Now, that mountain is in the Andes, and we are seeing the tropical glaciers retreating.
Well, yes. The problem isn't only in the poles of these ice caps melting. The glaciers are retreating at an alarming rate, and anyone who might have skepticism as far as what we call global warming or global change need only look at what happens to these glaciers in the Andes and elsewhere.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Fabien Cousteau, who with his sister Celine and father Jean-Michel Cousteau and a group of friends and scientists and translators and all sorts of other people returned to the Amazon after 25 years and put together a two-part documentary. The second part will be airing tonight at 8 p.m. on PBS.
Thank you very much.